early childhood, gender dysphoria and the early stages of same-sex attraction will look the same. When we cross emotional boundaries and become unhealthy emotionally, for women, emotions and sexual desire are closely related. And so for some women, once they cross the line into emotional unhealthiness, eventually those relationships become sexualized and they become physical.
Root issues, the same kind of things you were talking about that can feed into the development of same-sex attraction, both in boys and girls, that those are the same root issues that can develop into gender nonconformity or gender insecurity.
When God-given needs aren't met, those needs will either grow, they'll intensify, or they'll even take on another form. But oftentimes, they're not just going to go away.
The truth is, we are missing all the good. Like, my dad had so many good characteristics, so many good qualities, and I couldn't see any of them for how blind I was and how hateful I was toward everything else that was hurtful.
The child's detaching from what he actually needs. So God designed him to need bonding with his father and then bonding with male peers. If he's detaching because he perceives the father to be unwelcoming or scary, then he's not going to be receiving what he needs.
We have to make decisions that are based on choice about showing love and compassion, even when we're not feeling it.
I do believe that it's on us as Christians to continue to love. And I mean, the Bible talks about even loving your enemies, which hopefully
yes.
Parents aren't enemies. But if we're to love our enemies, we're certainly to love our family.
Those who have gone through that are post-surgery for some kind of medical intervention in the attempt to become the other gender, which is impossible. But for those that do that they are 19 times more likely, not 19%, but rather 19 times more likely to actually commit suicide.
Welcome to the Love and Truth Network podcast, your guide for hope and healing in a hurting world searching for truth. Here we explore God's extraordinary design for biblical sexuality, identity, and authentic community. You'll be impacted by incredible stories of transformation, practical wisdom from pastors and counselors, and the power of God's grace that changes lives.
Well, hey there, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Love and Truth Network podcast. Really glad that you're here with us. And I'm excited because I have a friend and ministry partner and someone that I just really highly respect with us today. Julie Hamilton has been with us once before when we first started our podcast more than 2 years ago now. I can't believe so much time has gone by, but I wanted to bring Julie back and speak to some additional issues beyond what we could cover in that 1 hour podcast way back in the beginning. So Julie, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me on here.
Yeah, I'm excited. In our first podcast, I would just reference our audience to go back and watch that. It was in the first 1 to 10 podcasts that we did. But you can listen to Julie share some of her own story, a little bit of her own family dynamic with you. And then we unpacked some things around, mostly around the topic of same-sex attraction, especially in boys and men. And I want to reprise that a little bit today, Julie, if we could. And also add to that some conversation about the development of same-sex attraction for women or girls. And then we want to talk about transgenderism and some of the ways of being helpful in that arena. What is helpful, what's not been helpful at all, what frankly needs to be discarded entirely. We have some other nations that have gone down that road before us and have actually decided this is, you know, so-called gender-affirming care is actually not producing health. It's actually damaging children. Obviously, it's making them sterile. There's all kinds of things that are going wrong with this process of so-called care and medical treatment. And so some countries are now totally sidelining that entirely. And yet it seems like in the U.S., in some states at least, we're doubling down on it. And so we want to talk to some of those issues, but also from your perspective as a marriage and family therapist, get your insights on what you find to be most helpful and talk about some of the resources you have available. So again, thank you so much for being here with us, Julie. Thank you for joining in our audience. We always appreciate you being here as well. And so let's just begin with a little bit of your own kind of credentials and background, Dr. Hamilton.
Okay. Yes, I'm a marriage and family therapist, and I have a private practice, but I also have been educating on the issue of same-sex attractions and specifically development. I've been educating for probably 25 years or so on, mm-hmm. on those topics. And so, I find that so many people have been misinformed when it comes to understanding homosexuality, transgenderism, understanding what, you know, some of the risk factors are in childhood. So that's why I really do like educating on this, because I think it's important information that a lot of people are not aware of.
Well, we definitely have to get the word out there and make people aware of the various resources, like your website. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but the various resources that are out there, and you're connected to a number of other groups as well. And we want to make sure that people are aware. There's really good, solid, science-based information that is out there that is not primarily ideology-driven first, but rather more research-based. And it really is about the care and nurture of children, certainly, and men and women in general as well. So Dr. Hamilton, let's talk a little bit about your homosexuality101.com resource that you put out years ago that is still very, very informative, that I would encourage people to go to and watch and listen to that. That's primarily oriented around the development of same-sex attraction for boys, but walk through just a little bit of a summary of what that can look like.
Okay. So yes, in that I talk about how same-sex attractions are, they kind of begin to be, you know, almost cultivated, or development really goes back to when a child is very, very young. And so when a baby is first born, the first attachment figure for a baby is the mother. So there's mm-hmm. bonding that needs to happen between the baby and the mother in order for healthy development to occur. And then the next stage in the bonding process is that between around the ages of 1.5 to about 4, within that window, the child then needs, for the development of gender identity, the child needs to bond with the same sex parent. So a little boy will begin to kind of, he's been bonding with the mother, but he'll kind of begin to gravitate towards the father during those early years between like 1.5 to 4. The little girl will need to stay bonded with the mother. And again, that's for the development of gender identity, in order to develop a secure gender identity. Now, both parents are important for overall development. Both parents are important in a child's life. But for gender identity, the primary, the first person that really pours in a sense of gender identity is going to be that same-sex parent. So a little boy will look to the father to begin to understand what it means to be male. And so through that relationship the father has with the boy will begin to kind of almost soak in a sense of masculinity through the father spending time with his son, affirming his son, playing with his son, just really bonding with the boy. And then the same for the girl with the mother. For the little girl, she begins to get a sense of what it means to be female through the relationship that she continues to have with her mother between 1.5 and 4. So that's kind of the beginning. I could go on or...
Yeah, no. What about, I wanted to talk a little bit about, and that was very much my experience as I look back and I hear you go through, especially the longer version that's available on homosexuality101.com. I'm like, oh my goodness, like that outlines my story. Oftentimes when I'm preaching or teaching and doing different events around the country, people will come up to me afterward and say to me, oh my gosh, you told my story. And what they really mean is their story is very different from mine. But what they're talking about is there are common themes that I didn't even realize were, as you're talking, it feels like you're telling my story, even though it's very different, because it's the themes are so similar. And I've that's been uncanny, because it applies. The truth is the themes do apply, you know, to how this can develop. But I'm wondering, I know from my experience and some things that you and I've talked about in the past as well, that the development within girls and women can be a little bit more complex in terms of the variables, I guess. What would you say to that?
Yes. Okay. So, and let me say one other thing that happens that is very important in the developmental process is that between age five and puberty, children need same-sex peer bonding. So I mentioned about this bond with the same-sex parent, but then the next stage from 5 years old on through puberty would be bonding with same-sex peers. So little boys need other boys to play with, and it's through the relationship with other boys that they continue to develop a more solid understanding of who they are in terms of their gender, and little girls need to bond with other little girls. So, but for girls, some of the other factors that can contribute to an insecure sense of gender identity, and by the way, for both, if they are not solidly bonding with the same-sex parent or parent figure or same-sex peers, it's very complex, and other factors may contribute as well, but if they're not getting that solid bond, that can set them up to be at risk for developing a more insecure sense of their gender.
Yes.
Other factors that can contribute to an insecure sense of gender identity for girls would be if a girl is watching, and both boys and girls watch the relationship dynamic between the parents. And so if they see the parents fighting, especially so if a little girl sees the father as someone who is harsh or mean, mean to the mother, she might not only develop a skewed view of masculinity, seeing her father, mm-hmm. if he's, let's say, abusive to the mother or harsh with the mother, but the girl might also develop the belief that being female means being weak. Like if she perceives her mom to be weak or perceives her mom to be a victim, she might develop a sense that being female is equated with being weak. So she may further detach from her gender, further detached from femininity because of a misperception of what it means to be female. So that's, yes. But there are other factors too. For some girls who end up with same-sex attractions or even women who end up in same-sex relationships who weren't previously identifying themselves as lesbian or, for some of these girls, it happens later. So for some girls, there may be a hurt that occurs in relation to a boy or a man. So, you know, certainly molestation or rape could be a factor that can contribute. And then for some women, you can see where you may know women who they were not identifying as LGBT, but they were even, you see women who were married, you know, opposite sex marriage. And then all mm-hmm. of a sudden you find that they've left their husband and they're in a relationship with a woman. For some of these, there's another factor called emotional dependency. And that's where a person, usually this happens more among women than among men. You can see this among men too. But for women, this can actually be a factor that leads them into a same-sex relationship. Because what happens is with emotional dependency, the woman becomes dependent on another woman for her overall sense of who she is. And so it's kind of, some people have called it relational idolatry, where yes. you're putting this person on the throne of your life, and this person is everything, and this person means more to you than anyone else or anything else. And before long, certainly we're not meant to be idolizing anyone. God should be the king of our lives, and no one else should be on that throne in our life. But when we cross emotional boundaries and become unhealthy emotionally, for women, emotions and sexual desire are closely related. And so for some women, once they cross the line into emotional unhealthiness, eventually those relationships become sexualized and they become physical as well. And there's, you know, maybe more we could say about it. It's a complex process, but yeah. that's kind of a general overall overview of what can happen, is that emotional dependency can lead a woman into thinking, oh, I'm in love with this person. And this is, you know, I'm, this is now who I am and who I need to be with. And so they kind of yep. develop a whole sense of being LGBT or really identifying in that way and having those attractions.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I found to be more unique to women. And that's why we're talking about this, is that generally, and I there's always exceptions, right? But generally the guys that I know who have had same-sex attraction would say, for as long as I can remember, or back when I was 10 or 11 or 12, I realized that I felt same-sex attracted, or whatever the case is. Oftentimes it's been through early pornography exposure and sexual exploration and things like that, that these kind of feelings rise to the surface. But and there could be many other factors besides those, but I don't even know if I know of a guy, maybe a couple, who have never experienced same-sex attraction. They get married, the marriage falls apart, and then they wind up, I actually can think of one person, they wind up from there getting into this kind of a emotionally enmeshed relationship that you're talking about, the emotional dependency, and that leading into now them identifying as gay and them, you know, pursuing a relationship with a guy. But that's extremely rare for men. Whereas for women, that does happen. I know all kinds of stories where that's happened, where there's been no previous, just as you said, no previous awareness of or acknowledgement of same-sex attraction. Even when you talk with them later in life, it's like, no, I really was just attracted to boys. I was attracted to my husband, but the marriage was, it was a bad marriage, abusive or whatever. And it, again, just opened the door for this emotionally enmeshed relationship. For the sake of understanding terms as well, you know, I think sometimes people will conflate emotional dependency with codependency. And while those can often be present in the same relationship, they're really two very different things. This idea of codependency, I want you to check me and correct me on this. If my understanding would be that I'm codependent on the addictive behavior or the damaging behavior that my spouse or my partner or whatever is indulging in or engaged in or addicted to or whatever. I wind up being addicted to kind of that whole environment around their addiction, whereas emotional dependency is really rooted more in my need, my longing to be loved and to be accepted, and this deep need that I have for this person to kind of meet all of my needs. And usually in emotional dependency, you mentioned the word idolatry. That was certainly true for me as well. Like, I did not want multiple friends. I wanted one friend, and I wanted that person to only want me in their life. And so it was a very exclusive, very unhealthy, so-called relationship that could not begin to bear the weight of all that we each of us needed in the relationship. We need others to come alongside of us in healthy ways as well. Just like in Christian marriages, for example, I think that way too many Christian marriages are leaning too heavily on the other person to meet all the needs of that individual. And you can speak to this from your counseling background for sure. But men need other guys, and women need some women in their lives who can minister to them and meet needs that the spouse meets unique needs that nobody else should be able to, but they can't meet all the needs. Can you kind of speak to all of that I just lumped together?
Yes, yes. So yes, I would agree with exactly what you said about that. Emotional dependency is much more common among women than among men, as far as being the catalyst for going into a same-sex relationship mm-hmm. without having a prior history. Usually for males, there is going to be a prior, those early childhood factors that I mentioned, the lack of the bonding, the lack of same-sex bonding, that for males kind of is cultivated over a lifetime. For women, some women do end up into same-sex relationships with factors that started very early on and it was cultivated over a lifetime. But there's also many women who don't have those early year factors contributing factors, and instead they find themselves in with same-sex attractions later in life. Both in adulthood, we also could see it in them for women. It can happen in the teen years as well, but whereas for boys, typically it starts very early in childhood, and you don't see just that sudden onset of it later in the teen years. You know, with codependency versus emotional dependency, I would agree with what you said, that the way you explained it. I would say that I typically think of codependency more in the area of substance abuse. We see that mm-hmm. used a lot, and that with codependency, the one who's not the addicted one is usually enabling that addictive behavior. Yes. That those are some of the components that we see when I think of the term codependency. It's kind of the maybe the person who just keeps giving money to the addict and, you know, keeps helping them, keeps bailing them out of their problems and won't let them hit rock bottom. And that would be that codependent and the addict, you know, depending on them to continue enabling them. So that I think of the term codependency more in that way. Whereas, like you said, with emotional dependency, it really is about, I am incomplete. I need someone to fill in the holes in my life. And like you said, one person, it's this one person. And often there's a lot of possessiveness, jealousy about anyone else, exclusivity. We all, you know, with emotional dependency, it's, I only want this person. I want this person all to myself. I don't want anyone else, to be a part of this. And so it is more, I agree with your definition. It is more about just getting emotional needs met and really trying to fill holes. I always encourage couples, it starts too with God being our first need meter, really, that our dependency, our ultimate dependency for everything should start with God. And then people are the icing on the cake. God did make us relational, so we do need people in our lives. And God did design marriage to be a very close and intimate relationship. But that's right, a spouse is not supposed to be everything to a person. And men do need male friends, women need female friends. It's good to have people in our lives. And I think the church, the Bible talks about the church as a family, an extended family and community. Yes. And so that's what's wonderful about the people of God is that we can have wide range of relationships, and we can have older people who we're looking up to. We can have younger people that are looking up to us, and we can have, mm-hmm. Various levels of friendship. But certainly I would agree that when yep. a marriage, when you're looking to your spouse to meet your every need, it can become an unhealthy burden on a marriage.
Yes. Yes. Well, so we were talking a little bit ago about emotional dependency and how that can play a real role in the development of, well, brokenness in general, but certainly it's part of the facet of the possible development of same-sex attraction. But also kind of alongside of that, or maybe almost opposite of that, is defensive detachment, where we defensively detach from the pain usually. I did this with my dad for sure. I did this with men in general. I just felt like I didn't fit into the world of boys and men. Also, one of the other factors for me wasn't just the lack of connection with my father, but it was for me in the development of same-sex attraction and even some struggles with some identity confusion around my gender early on in my life was the fact that I over-identified with my mom and my sister and girls at church, girls at school. I just felt like they make a whole lot more sense to me. They're safer. I'm not being bullied by them, all that kind of thing. And so there's the emotional dependency that set in some sense pretty quickly, but there was the defensive detachment piece. And then also that longing to again be accepted by my own peers, as we talked about. But I'm just wondering how, in defensive detachment, what kind of role does that play alongside of emotional dependency?
So in that early stage, when the child is, the boy is trying to attach to the father, if he perceives the father to be unsafe or unwelcoming, he might do what some have called as defensive detachment. He might defensively detach from his father. So it's this idea where he thinks the father's rejecting him, whether the father really is or not, remains to be known, because perceptions is such a big thing. But he says to himself, okay, if you're rejecting me, then I'm rejecting you. And he puts up this wall and he detaches. And this is an important stage when he should be attaching to the father, not detaching. But he does this in self-protection, because he feels rejected if he's trying to attach, but he thinks the father doesn't want him, or if the father's too busy, or if the father's too scary, then the child pulls back, and it's a way of protecting himself. And then what often happens is that for these boys who end up with same-sex attractions is that he then will stay connected to the mom. And then usually for the boys that end up with same-sex attractions or gender confusion, there's usually other women in his life. Yeah. He usually has a grandmother, aunts, sister, cousins, lots of females. At this time when he needs to be soaking in masculinity, he's soaking in femininity from all of the females that he is surrounded by. So defensive detachment, you asked how that connects with emotional dependency. So if the child's detaching from what he actually needs, so God designed him to need bonding with his father and then bonding with male peers. If he's detaching because he perceives the father to be unwelcoming or scary, then he's not going to be receiving what he needs. He'll be receiving female love, but he won't be receiving that male bonding that he needs in order to develop a healthy sense of who he is as a male. So later, he'll still be craving to fill the void that was missed, because it is a void. If you're putting up a wall that, not open to the relationship with the father, then that becomes a void. The male love is now missing, and that's a void. And so what happens is when God-given needs aren't met, those needs will either grow, they'll intensify, or they'll even take on another form. But oftentimes they're not just going to go away. If it's a God-given need and it doesn't get met, it's going to need to be met still in a right way, but oftentimes it'll kind of take on another form where children will grow to crave that need to be met in maybe a wrong way. And so emotional dependency is one of those wrong ways of, kind of almost emotional dependency results in a clinging on and a kind of just like a desperation, like fill me up. And that's why you see that possessiveness and exclusivity and jealousy, because it's just this, I need you to fill this hole. And really God designed us to be, our needs to be met in right ways. And when we try to fill them in wrong ways, it never really works. And it often leads to more problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, what you just described is my life, the themes of my life. And I want to highlight something here that you just mentioned is that these are legitimate and important needs that need to be met. And I thought for years after God had brought me into genuine salvation at 23. And then, you know, there were some really wonderful positive experiences of walking with him. And then there's some deep, deep failure. He brought me to a church that in my mid-30s, coming out of my sexual addiction and again, identity confusion and a lot of other things, that he brought me into this church that eventually I did get into their men's group. Eventually I did find a band of brothers, but in my mid-30s, and what I found, I've often said this and might have even said it in a recent podcast, it was kind of a weird experience. And yet I was conscious after it kind of started, I realized, oh my gosh, these men that now know my story that I finally opened up to and shared my story with as a group, which was terrifying to me, but their acceptance of me, not acceptance of my sin, but their acceptance of me and their desire, literally saying, Gary, we are so glad you're here and you belong with us. Well, I'd never heard those words in my entire life from the Christian community of men, anywhere that I've been, any of the churches I've been in. And so to hear that and to experience them following that up with a desire to connect and all that, it was very much like in my mid-30s going through a form of what I should have had at 9, 10, 11, 12 years old of that peer acceptance. So what God often does, he doesn't just like wave a wand and fix all the issues and poof, you now have what only maturity could give you or experiences could give you. Rather, even at those later ages, he's able to connect us with people who can help us. And one of the things that was happening in my life is I was with the group. I wasn't exclusively with one individual guy, right? So it was that group bonding and very much God put meat on the bones of my masculine skeletal frame that was still very sparse, even up to that point, even serving in ministry. And so I love what you're talking about because it's so true. And I love how God can bring us back around, you know, to repair those damages, that issue.
Yes, that's a perfect example of the needs being met in a right way. They weren't met early on when you needed it. And so it became a hunger for, you know, bonding and fitting in and feeling like you're part of the world of men. I mean, that's what exactly, like you said, in those earlier years in elementary school and even in middle school is when you would have had that. But now in your late 20s and 30s, you're getting that bonding with, and it's filling in the gaps, the bonding with men. And like you said, because it wasn't just one man, it was a group of men, and it was in a church setting, and you were a part of their world of just all things manly, it filled in those gaps, filled in those voids for you.
It was so healing. Yeah.
Yes.
And before we shift to spend kind of the latter half of our podcast time discussing transgenderism and gender identity issues and dysphoria and those kinds of things. And more importantly, how to help and support in a way that's really useful and helpful in people's lives. There was a guy that a friend of mine and a ministry follower who texted me just before you and I went on together, who said, Gary, I was just listening to a podcast you did recently and you talked about defensive detachment. So again, we're talking about that here. And one of the things that he asked is would this be the same thing as reactive attachment disorder? And I would love your thoughts on that. From my perspective, I think that when I look at defensive detachment, I feel like that's something that tends to happen a bit later in life. It can happen early in childhood, but I think oftentimes for me, I know the defensive detachment really happened closer to puberty, probably, and going through puberty. I came out of that really despising my dad. Later on, my dad and I developed a great relationship after I became an adult. I love my dad very, very much. But in childhood, I really hated him and in my teen years. And that defensive detachment happened for me a little bit later. But it was a conscious thing. It wasn't like I was saying, oh, I'm going to defensively detach. But it was more of this kind of this inner vow of I'm just growing to despise you. I don't want to have anything. You don't engage with me. I don't know how to relate to you. And it was just this shutting down of everything within me toward him. That was defensive detachment toward me. And similar in how I hear other people describe that, both men and women. Again, it can look differently, but similar kind of inner vow kind of stuff. Whereas reactive attachment disorder, from my understanding, is something that really is rooted more in oftentimes in adoptive situations where children have never had love and affection. Or very, very, very little of it. Their basic needs weren't taken care of, maybe for food and nourishment, but often just left emotionally. There's no snuggling. We know now when babies are born, the first thing you want to do is get that skin on skin with mom or skin on skin with dad, usually mom. But when babies don't have that at all, and they're just kind of left to have their basic food and, you know, nurturing needs taken care of, but nothing emotionally, I think that reactive attachment disorder can set in so early. Like, there's no conscious attempt on the child's part. There's just a lack of disconnection. They become familiar with that disconnect and they don't even know how. It's something that I think can be developed, but it takes a lot of work because there's no emotional for that particular child dealing with reactive attachment disorder. There's no emotional longing. Like, they've missed something. They don't know what they're even missing. They just have a gap, and it's hard to know how to even fill that in. That's probably not explained terribly well, but what are your thoughts about the differences between those two things?
Yes, I would agree with you that that reactive attachment disorder is referring to the lack of bonding that needs to happen very early on for babies in infancy. Mm-hmm. So it's the lack of bonding at all with caregivers. And that sets a child up for all sorts of problems because personality development does stem out of the bonding and the attachment that occurs from infancy on. And defensive detachment is a term that was used to describe when a boy is specifically detaching from the father in relation to the relationship with the father, but also how that affects gender development. And so I would say it's defensive detachment refers more specifically to detaching from the boy, detaching from the father. And that, mm-hmm. and like you said, for you, you actually remember when that happened, you can kind of remember those thoughts of, I don't want to be like you. We don't relate. I don't have anything in common. And so typically the term has been used to describe what happens in that early stage of which has often been called the gender identification phase between 1.5 and about 4. And it's that, so that detaching typically it starts there, but it can carry on. And like you said, I think with even with male peers being detached, it can become a posture of detachment from the male world. So male peers, I see that with boys where they, even teenage boys, where they are afraid to even approach other boys. They're afraid because they feel so insecure and inadequate. And because they have detached, you know, earlier on from masculinity, thinking that they are not equipped to relate to masculinity.
Well, our podcasts are totally organic. And so as you're sharing, there's one other thing that comes to my mind I would love your thoughts on, especially as a marriage and family therapist, is the other category that I oftentimes see, the other demographic would be a better way of saying it, that I often see employing a kind of defensive detachment. Again, I understand totally that term was kind of coined for boys detaching from their fathers, girls detaching from their mothers, and specifically around these kinds of issues. But where I see this also playing out, having been a pastor for 12 years and overseeing our lay counseling ministry and support groups, et cetera, and doing a fair amount of even marriage counseling as a pastor, not as a licensed therapist, where I see defensive detachment, a kind of defensive detachment happening is within the life of Christian women or women in general who have basically come into their marriages with, you know, with wonderful expectations and believing that it's going to be a wonderful experience of bonding with their husband and those kinds of things. And when the husband does not bond well, does not connect well with his wife, it's like what I've seen over and over is that she kind of takes it. She's trying to reach out and kind of draw him closer. He kind of is in the posture of hands out, pushing her away in a sense, not physically, but emotionally. And over the course of time, she becomes more and more disheartened, more and more discouraged. And at some point, when I've seen this with Christian women who love Jesus, and I've seen it with women more than men, that she finally gets to a point where she is absolutely done. And she disconnects in a way that I think is similar to what boys can do and girls can do with their same-sex parent. She detaches in a way that really she loses what she's had for all of these years as a longing and a desire to bond more deeply. And she's staying in that that fight and that struggle, trying to help the marriage deepen. And so I see this a lot. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that as well. A totally different topic, I understand, but there's no one better for me to ask this of than you with your background and your degree.
You know what? I would say I would agree with you with exactly what you've said. In fact, probably 20 years ago, I was teaching at the graduate level, and I had a colleague that was older than me and had been teaching for so many years prior. And he described just exactly what you're describing. He said, and he described it that he found over those years, and I have seen this to be true as well, that for women, that they try and they try and they try, and oftentimes the husbands don't take them seriously. They don't, when the wife is saying, I need more, I want more, I, you know, our marriage could be better, it could be deeper, but the husband doesn't take it seriously. And for some women, they get to a point after 20 years, 25 years, where they just give up. And they, it's like they hit a wall, and it is very hard to help them recover from that. And so sadly, what I have seen is I've had husbands in my offices saying, I didn't realize she was, you know, and it's too late. And they're devastated. They are devastated. Mm-hmm. They don't want to lose their wife. In some cases, the wives leave. In some cases, they just shut down and they, you know, aren't trying anymore or caring anymore. Sadly, their feelings are. And it's so sad because that's when the husbands realize. And yet it sometimes is. Now, as Christians, we know that it's never too late and God can bring about restoration. But I do see that, that just giving up and that hitting a wall and kind of like, I think that could probably that defensive detachment could be a term that could fit because it is this kind of like, okay, that's it. I'm done. And then it's so tragic. Yeah.
And I do want to just address, so for me, there was a point where I had to start making some decisions to reengage with my father. And a lot of me didn't want to do that. Like I had no emotional investment anymore. I didn't really care. I didn't want to have anything. I actually didn't like him, all those kinds of things. But again, after getting out of the house and kind of getting on my own, going through some of my own really rough stuff, I guess, relationally and things like that, my mom and my dad were always there. They were always available. They didn't always have the greatest advice in the world. They didn't, you know, they didn't necessarily, but they loved me and it was evident by their presence and their availability. And at some point though, I had to start making some decisions, and this is what, and it's different. And yet there's some similarity with women that I've seen be able to turn that corner and come back again. It usually does take years. It does. It's not over in a week or a month, and husbands that finally have these come to Jesus moments and real wake up calls. And now they're crushed because they look back over how they've destroyed this woman and how they've destroyed the relationship by just ignoring it and thinking, oh, she's just too needy and all that. That finally he gets some help and some input and realizes, oh my gosh, it's been me all this time. I should have been engaged more. And now she's disconnected. But how do you, A, we need to be willing to persevere in the mess that we ourselves have primarily created as men, and also as parents that we have the same kind of wake-up call with their children that are defensively detached. But then there's something that's on us as teenagers or young adults to choose, especially as ones who are believers, to decide, okay, this honor your father and mother thing is not optional. And I have got to start reengaging. And also, the truth is, we are missing all the good. Like, my dad had so many good characteristics, so many good qualities, and I couldn't see any of them for how blind I was and how hateful I was toward everything else that was hurtful. And so it's also to our benefit to begin to open up those doors again and invite God to warm our hearts and reattach what we've severed. And I think that's also true for, it could be true for Christian men toward their wives, but I find it again more often with Christian wives toward their husbands. So we have to be patient in the process, whether we're moms or dads or we're husbands that have kind of created some of this mess, because it's going to take time. And it's going to take small consistencies where big events that are inconsistent are not going to be helpful, right? So what would you say though, specifically to Christian wives or young people who have defensively detached in terms of choosing to warm their own hearts, choosing to open themselves up again to the possibility that this person is showing evidence that they've changed and they really do want relationship. How do we open ourselves back up again?
Yes, yes. Oh, that's such a good question. You have brought up also kind of your, I'm thinking of another problem that I see in our culture right now, which I, and maybe because of the, you know, the idea about cancel culture, where people are just cutting off. I see so many adult children cutting their parents off. And I almost, it's, to me, I think it's an epidemic right now. It's kind of a trend, I think, that if we don't, I hear the buzzwords that you hear all the time. Well, they're toxic. I need to have good boundaries. Now, boundaries have a place, but for some people, boundaries mean they're out of my life. I don't, and I hear people say, I don't
those are walls, not boundaries.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good way to put it. I hear people say, I don't need this in my life. But the truth is, relationships do take hard work, and they can be refining on us as well as we persevere and we press in to continue to love those who are difficult to love. And I think I'm not saying, you know, I think, you know, every situation is unique and everyone has to answer to God for how they handle their relationships. But just in general, I think people are giving up too easily on relationships. And you were talking about wives reaching that breaking point with their husbands where they're just kind of done. And it sort of has spilled over into what, and you mentioned with kids also and their parents, but my heart really goes out to these families that are torn apart because of adult children saying you weren't good parents, you're toxic, or, you know, whatever the terms are being used. And I don't need this in my life anymore. And so, you know, what do they call it? Going no contact, I think, is the new buzzword for cutting off your parents. And I totally agree with you about honor your father and mother is a serious command. And there's a promise with that, that it will go well with you and that you'll live long on the earth. So whether it is the beaten down wife who's beaten down because she's tired of trying and not getting anything out of it, or whether it's the children who grew up and didn't look back and have maybe pain over their childhood or don't like how their parents are. I do believe that it's on us as Christians to continue to love. And I mean, the Bible talks about even loving your enemies, which hopefully parents aren't enemies, but if we're to love our enemies, we're certainly to love our family. And even when you mentioned, you know, if you see that they're changing, sometimes even when they don't change, I feel like we find ways to love. I talked to some people about in relating to their parents as, you know, they may never give you what you want. Like, you know, you said maybe they didn't always have the good advice. You know, sometimes people go to their parents wanting something, or a wife goes to her husband wanting more emotional connection, more emotional support. Sometimes we do have to get to a point where we realize they may not be capable of giving us what they want, but what are they capable of? And I think what you said is great about your dad. All his faults were overshadowing the good qualities. And the truth is, people have strengths and weaknesses, and the weaknesses are often more dominant. That is often what we see the most, is the weakness. And we have to be willing to look past the weakness to see what are the strengths. So there's a couple of things with that. One is having realistic expectations. What are, like for a wife, what is the husband capable of giving and not giving? For the parent, even the child towards the parents, the adult child towards the parents, what are parents capable of? Some parents are not empathetic. Some parents aren't good listeners. Some parents are selfish and they really don't think about the child as much as they think about themselves. So we have realistic expectations and realize that, you know, compassion, empathy, unconditional love might not even be their strength. So how can I love them anyway? And sometimes with adult children towards parents, I talk about maybe you have to think of it as ministry. Rather than thinking of parents, typically parents, when you're young, parents give, it's all give. The parents give, the child takes early on emotionally. That's how it should be. Parents give. Children aren't supposed to meet parents' needs. Parents meet children's needs. As they get older, it kind of shifts out and it becomes more, you know, more like a friendship, more give and take in adulthood. But maybe you have parents that aren't givers emotionally. They maybe don't have a lot to give. So maybe you have to think in terms of ministry. I'm going to love my parents and they're going to be more of a ministry, and I'm going to have other people that pour into my life, but I'm just going to pour into my parents' life because they have nothing to give. Or maybe they have something to give and you just have to discover what it is. But I do think it is important. And so realistic expectations is one thing. And then being able to see past the praying. Here's one thing I do encourage people to pray. Say, God, help me to see this person or these people through your eyes. Help me to see them through your eyes. I have the hurts. Talk to God about the hurts. You know, they've done this, they've done that. This is where I'm hurting. Cry out to God, as David in the Psalms often cried out to God, pouring out your heart. Lord, I'm hurting. I feel like I can't take it anymore. This is what they've done to me. So you kind of vent and you express the hurt that's there in this relationship. But then when you're done, a couple things I say. The next thing is, when you're dealing with a difficult person, vent to God, express the hurt and the pain to God. And when you're expressing to God, it's important, I think, to end with truth and praise. Like, okay, yes. Lord, you're going to see me through. You love me. Thank you that yes. you're there for me. Thank
which
you.
Which David also did. Yes.
Yes, which David did. Exactly. He set a good example of doing that. Then I think it's important to say, okay, now, Lord, show me my part. Have I done wrong to them? Is there something, there, you know, the verse about the, we're trying to get the speck out of someone else's eye when we have a beam. Mm-hmm. It goes on to say, we don't even know there's a beam in our own life. We don't see the beam in our own life. So I think when we're dealing with someone difficult, after we've vented and expressed to God and we've anchored ourselves with truth and praise, the next thing is, Lord, if I'm contributing in this, if I'm wrong in any way, please show me, help me to see what I need to work on in me. Mm-hmm. And then do that work on, once we're working on ourselves, we're less preoccupied with the faults of the other person.
Yes.
And then
yes.
the last thing is, Lord, help me to see them through your eyes and help me to give grace. You've given grace and love to me and forgiveness. Help me to do the same towards them.
Yeah.
You know, I actually heard someone on your podcast talk about this. It was Josh Inman was one of your guests. And yes. I think if I heard him correctly, he said that he had held a grudge against his father for a long time, but he later realized there, I think he maybe went back and read a letter that his dad had written, and he realized he had a misperception that what he was holding on to something, but he went back and realized he misperceived something. Mm-hmm. And he actually went back and apologized. And I think that's the other thing is, we have our perceptions, but sometimes yes. our perceptions are inaccurate. And so mm-hmm. we hold on to, you know, things and think someone has wronged us. And sometimes they have wronged us, but sometimes there's misperception, or sometimes it's a little bit of both. So yep. really asking God for clarity and to see yes. our sin and to work on our sin and to see them with compassion and to see them through
yep.
God's
and,
eyes.
And I love everything you just said, Julie, and I want to shift kind of back to the main thing we are doing the podcast for, where I led us away down this rabbit trail, but I think it was an important one to go down. I just feel like there may be somebody listening to this that would benefit from this discussion with regard to wives and husbands and even older children who have been defensively detached and how to re-engage again. But what I would say about all this too, to kind of overlay everything that you said, which is so good, is that we have to make decisions as adults before the Lord now, not as ones who are bound to just kind of follow along with whatever our parents are deciding as children or what have you. But now that we are adults making our own decisions, we have to make decisions that are based on choice about showing love and compassion, even when we're not feeling it. Because in the beginning, we're not going to feel it. In the beginning, we might feel the opposite. And what we're not talking about is to re-engage in a truly abusive situation. We're not saying that at all. But yeah. in these places where genuine relationship could be repaired and we have these walls of defensive detachment up, how can we take them down? Well, one of the ways we can go through the steps, and what I found to be true is the emotions will re-engage, but they've been severed. They've been cut off. We have numbed them just to avoid the pain. It's going to take some time, but we can still act. We can still do, when I don't mean pretend, but we can still make choices that are good and wholesome. And the emotions will eventually follow those, but we can do them without the emotion. Don't wait around for the emotion to happen, all these positive, fuzzy, you know, warm and fuzzy feelings to happen. Go ahead and make the decisions to be in proximity to and make good choices around doing your part, my part, to re-engage where I can in these relationships and see what God will do with that. So.
Yes, 100%. Yes. I agree. Where we invest our energy, our feelings will follow. And so investing, yes, there's a verse, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.
That's right.
I heard a pastor preach once about investing your energy into loving others and that your heart will mm-hmm. follow. And so definitely, I agree with you. You do have to take steps without the feelings sometimes.
Well, one of the things you and I were talking about is that before the podcast, we were talking about how the same root issues, the same kind of things you were talking about that can feed into the development of same-sex attraction, both in boys and girls, that those are the same root issues or series cluster of issues that can develop into gender nonconformity or gender insecurity. So I want to talk a little bit about transgenderism now and just kind of build on what you've already explained there. How would you connect those things, transgender, gender dysphoria, connected back to even the development of same-sex attraction?
Yes, yes. And again, just wanting to clarify that their human development is very complex. So I'll share with you my, you know, the things that I think do contribute, but there are lots of factors that go into it. But but this this overlap is that often in the early years, in early childhood, gender dysphoria and the early stages of same-sex attraction will look the same. So for some children, starting between the ages of 3-4 years old, you'll begin to see them not being confident and comfortable in their gender. So little boys who are gravitating more towards girls or wanting to play with girl toys and things like that, or little girls gravitating more towards boy things. Now, there's varying degrees to how deep that will go in a child's heart. There are some children who really just believe they are not the boy that they are or not the girl that they are. They desperately want to be the other. And there are some who maybe don't have such an extreme feeling of that, but more of just insecure in being the boy that they are or the girl that they are, or not comfortable in that. But it will often look very similar, that you see this either gender insecurity or gender nonconformity early on. And for some, they will outgrow. In fact, the research has showed before this current phase of time that we're in our culture with the transgender ideology and the ways that children are being encouraged to socially transition, before all of that began, so years ago, the research showed that children who were gender dysphoric or gender confused early in childhood, 80 to 90% of those would outgrow the desire to be the opposite sex, but they would instead be gay or lesbian. So those early years were the really just the beginning stages of later developing same-sex attractions. Keep in mind, sexual attractions don't really develop until puberty or after puberty. So that's why in the beginning, they're not identifying as gay, because they don't have sexual attractions either way, for boy, you know, opposite or same-sex attractions. But early on, it's gender insecurity or gender nonconformity. Then it grows into, after puberty, realizing, oh, I'm attracted to the same sex. For some, for the smaller number of those children, they would continue to want to be the opposite sex in, you know, into early adulthood and continuing on from there. Now, we're not sure what's going to happen, because these children who have gender insecurity or nonconformity, they're being encouraged to socially transition and go ahead and be the opposite sex. And we know that the ones that end up on hormones later, I think what we're seeing is that 100% of those continue on taking further steps towards transitioning. Mm-hmm. Eventually, many of those get to a point where they detransition, but the ones that begin the steps of hormones will often take further steps and continue down that road quite a while. So anyway, to answer your question, some of those early risk factors are the same for both same-sex attractions and gender dysphoria.
And what you were just talking about, how many who get on hormone therapy, maybe the vast majority, nearly 100%, will move on to some other medical intervention, top surgery, bottom surgery, other things, facial feminization, a variety of different things they can choose. Not everyone does choose that, but a vast majority wind up, and I've heard it described as the goalpost keeps moving. You know, whether it's a social transition, a name change, people are now calling me by my so-called preferred pronoun or pronouns, and all of that feels amazing. I'm now kind of on my way to being this other person, and after a while, you have to do the next thing because it doesn't satisfy any longer, which again kind of propels people toward further and further attempts at so-called transition. But what I've also read, I remember years ago now reading Ryan T. Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally, and I've read some stats since then that talk about those who have gone through that are post-surgery for some kind of medical intervention in the attempt to become the other gender, which is impossible. But for those that do that, that they are 19 times more likely, not 19%, but rather 19 times more likely to actually commit suicide. What do you understand about those statistics?
Yes, and I don't remember I had the statistic, but certainly there is a higher percentage of those who, there's higher suicide rates among those who have transitioned. And yes, now there are so many factors that also that go into it. So for some, there are, so when when you see someone who is not feeling comfortable in their own skin as the male or female that they are, and they are so uncomfortable that they either they think that they're the opposite sex or they want to become the opposite sex, there's a lot going on. And for some of these, there are other mental health issues that are going on. And the problem that is that when we're saying the solution is let's go ahead and let them move towards trying to become the opposite sex. Now we know they can never really be the opposite sex, but when we present the solution as let's go ahead and go in that direction, we're missing the opportunity to deal with all of the other things. There's often depression and other mental health issues that are being completely ignored. So it's almost like putting a Band-Aid on something that's pretty severe. And so that's why I always advocate for let's deal with the underlying issues, especially in early childhood and in the teen years. To ignore the underlying issues and just say, well, this is the answer. Let's help them try to be the opposite sex seems just so negligent and risky and problematic.
Well, and you and I are going to just kind of barely scratch the surface of the issue here, but you have been part of developing this amazing video that's over an hour long, actually, but it's worth the watch and the listen that really dives into how to effectively address these issues. You have testimonies on there. Talk a little bit about that video. And then I also recall that you yourself in the video were talking about the three different kinds of attempts to resolve gender dysphoria and you kind of unpacked that a little bit. So talk about the video, where it's located, how people can see it. And then also if you would touch on those three different approaches to addressing gender dysphoria.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. I developed this video because I realized that a lot of professionals don't really know how to help these children. It's not, you know, there was this change from this used to be called gender identity disorder years ago, where it was looked at as a problem. If a little boy thought he was a girl, there's a problem. It's a disorder, and we need to help them really figure out how to be comfortable with who they are, be comfortable in their own skin. Well, then the shift, the name actually was changed to gender dysphoria, which is a complete change of even where what you're thinking about, how you're thinking about this issue. So instead of it being a disorder, it's now seen as not a problem that the child, the boy thinks he's a girl or the girl thinks she's a boy. The problem is if it stresses them out, if they're, it's more about now let's help try to alleviate the stress. And so that's a very different way of thinking about it. And but I tend to think it's a problem if a little boy thinks he's a girl. There's more that we need to deal with there.
Let me clarify that a little bit and make sure I'm understanding. So what you're referencing, I believe, is from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5. There were probably a lot of changes, but one of the changes had to do with the definition. And one was in the DSM-4, it was gender identity disorder, and in the DSM-5, it's now gender dysphoria. And the emphasis has, and to the layman, you'd look at that and think, oh, what's the big deal? They're kind of the same thing. They're not the same thing at all. The one, as you're saying, in the DSM-4, it was still considered an issue that a boy or a girl, a man or a woman would believe that they were in the wrong gender, like that's, or they're in the wrong body. That's a problem. Like that's a mental health issue that we need to come alongside of them and with love and patience and care, help them resolve that. Whereas in the DSM-5, now the emphasis is on, oh, we don't have to change. If you think you're in the wrong body and you're supposed to be the other one, that's perfectly fine. We just need to help you resolve your distress around that so you can move toward that actually and be comfortable with it. Those are radically different things.
That's right. That's right. Thank you for clarifying. That's exactly right. Yes. So in recent years, therapists don't seem to be, from what I can tell, are not trained in how to help children who are gender dysphoric or gender confused. Right. And so I saw this as kind of a gaping hole that therapists need to understand there are reasons these children have the confusion and there are things that can be done to help them. So I had this opportunity to develop a video, a training video, and the purpose behind it is that it would be a training tool for therapists, for pediatricians, psychologists, family physicians to understand what's going on and how do you help these children and teenagers. And it also, as it turns out, I think the video is also helpful for pastors and ministry leaders, youth leaders. I think it's also helpful for parents. So we kind of see that it has a wider reach now. But the idea was that this would be a training tool. That's why it's so long. It's like an hour and a half. A lot of times we're not used to sitting for that long, but it was designed to be a training tool. And I think that it is a really important training tool and professionals really need it. And I think parents can benefit from it as well.
And well, there's no simple answers to these complex issues. And so to even get something as comprehensive as what you have in that length of time, a couple of hours is or an hour and a half, whatever it is, it's vital and well worth sitting down. And if it takes a few times to get through it, it's packed with great information and again, great testimonies.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's free to watch online at genderidentity101.com. Totally free because I want people to get educated. People need to understand this because these children and teenagers need help. And I don't think the help that they're being offered is in the medical community or psychological community is not really what it needs to be. So anyway, and you know, the other great thing about this video, I was able to interview two of the world's leading experts. So Dr. Kenneth Zucker has worked with this and Dr. Susan Bradley, they've worked with children since the 1970s and they have been considered some of the world's leading experts in gender dysphoria. And their approach was always from the beginning, their approach was try to help a child be more comfortable in their own skin, and which is logical. It makes the most sense. They're not coming from a Christian background. They're not looking at this. They're just looking at this as psychologists. One's a psychologist, one's a psychiatrist, but looking at it just psychologically. But then we did in this video training, we have added in the Christian component and we do have testimonies sharing their stories, people sharing their stories of overcoming and how God helped them to overcome.
Yeah. So, well, the idea that we have somehow been influenced by the culture to believe that to love well is to simply affirm what somebody desires for themselves, no matter what age they are, no matter how informed they are, no matter the lack of informed consent as to what they're doing, their lack of ability to even think about as a 14-year-old girl, well, do I even want to have children? Well, maybe not at all as a 14-year-old. Maybe that's completely unappealing and understandably so. But then you get to be, I mean, I'm thinking of Chloe Cole and just what she's gone through and what her parents faced even as one at least mental health counselor was using a very familiar pressure point in saying, do you want a dead daughter or a live son? I mean, that's a very common thing that I've heard from many, many parents that is a refrain that's going around as if this is the only alternative. Either you go down this road, you permanently medicalize your child and put them in this situation where they have to be pumped full of opposite sex, cross-sex hormones that we have no idea all the ramifications, what this is going to do to their body. We know some of the things, very damaging things it's going to do, but including bone density, brain development, sterilization, I mean, all kinds of stuff that's happening. And the idea that somehow, oh, that's loving, as opposed to helping a child become congruent with who God made them to be on the outside as well as the inside. Oh my goodness. I mean, that's they seem light years apart to me. And yet somehow the idea, I know that there are people who genuinely believe the most loving thing to do is to not, as soon as a child expresses anything about wanting to be the opposite sex, or they're curious about it, or they don't like their own sex. But again, I ask all the time, like when I'm preaching or teaching, hey, anybody who is in the room, would you raise your hand if you loved going through puberty? I mean, would you just let me know? Because I've never met anybody who just was thrilled over that process. Everybody is uncomfortable going through that. And to take children that are in those most vulnerable situations of their life, of shifting from childhood into adulthood, going through puberty and saying, if you feel uncomfortable in your own skin, you're probably the opposite sex. I mean, that's unbelievably egregious to me. And the opposite of being loving. But I know that some people, many people, believe that somehow that's the most loving thing to do.
Right. And I think we've kind of redefined what love really is. Love is truthful. And love is, love sees the best, what's best for the person. And,
that's
and
right.
Certainly if it's a, you know, parent with a child, there are going to be lots of times that in love we say no, you know, we have limits, we redirect, we steer them.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. A lot of parents are feeling pressured and they're getting misinformation. And so I think the parents are it's sad. They're just as much kind of a, not a victim, but, you know, just a byproduct of misinformation in the culture. And so they're scared and they don't know what to do. And so they think that this is what they have to do. So it's, I think that's why it's, education has always been so important to me. The more we can help people to see the facts and to understand, and yes. and certainly from a Christian perspective, we live our lives according to God's word, not according to how we feel, or not according to, you know, certainly not according to emotions and so forth. So yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you were referencing in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 6, I quote this a lot, but we're told that love rejoices, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. And so that has to be, as Christians, that has to be a watchword. That has to be a benchmark. We have to recognize that if we are going beyond that in an attempt to love, then we are trying to supposedly love better than God. And if that doesn't give us pause, you know, we need to be able to love in truth. I was just thinking as we were talking here, my 14-year-old, both of my boys are in a classical model of homeschooling. And my youngest son, my 14-year-old, was reading Abigail Schreier's Bad Therapy. And so, you know, it's funny that my 14-year-old is reading something, you know, by Abigail. But that, I love that book. It's so good. She was writing in there something about gentle parenting. It's always been around in a sense, but this new kind of phase of everything is about parenting from the perspective of the child, and there's never really much correction. It's the child's leading everything, and it's all, oh my God, my son put that down as he was reading that. He's like, Dad, I haven't always liked the way you disciplined, but oh my gosh, I'm so grateful that you raised us the way your mom and you have raised us the way you have. I can't even imagine. This is crazy making, you know? And so my 14-year-old recognizes that and recognizes the value of addressing head on, like, sinful things, you know, and attitudes that are not good and not healthy, and helping to form and shape their character, you know? So anyway, Julie, I'd love for people to know how to locate you. You've shared with where they can locate the video on transgenderism, but what other ways can people connect with you or follow you?
Okay. So the genderidentity101.com website has all the training information. And then my other website, and I think they connect, you can link to me, but, drjuliehamilton.com has all the other information on it that you would
want. Awesome. Well, Julie, thanks so much for joining us and taking time out of your busy schedule to be a part of our podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been fun talking with you.
Awesome. Well, hey, everybody, thanks for joining us for another episode of the Love and Truth Network podcast. I hope this has been a really informative and helpful and challenging podcast episode for you. We'll see you in a future episode. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us for the Love and Truth Network podcast. We hope that the stories and insights shared have ignited in you a sense of God's powerful love for you and given you encouragement for your own journey toward relational and sexual wholeness. Remember, transformation is absolutely possible when rooted in grace, truth, and authentic biblical community. Subscribe today, share with a friend, share with your pastor, and we look forward to seeing you in our next Love and Truth Network podcast.